That was a little from Isaiah Rashad's new album, It's Been Awful. This is Boy in Red featuring SZA on vocals. This was one, you know, this album when it came out, we were both talking about it right away. It's been, how long has it been out now? Like a couple weeks?
Yeah, maybe about a month.
May 1st it dropped. So yeah, a little over a month. Damn. This album, when it first dropped, I listened to it right away. You know, big fan of Isaiah Rashad. It didn't hit me right away. It kind of just washed over me.
Okay.
Where I didn't dislike it, but it was just didn't feel like any tracks really stuck out to me. Aside from the first single.
Now you on some bullshit. No.
And this wasn't the album's fault at all. Like I listened to it and it just like kind of washed through me. I don't know if it was like my own shit I was dealing with. It just wasn't in the mood. It didn't strike me right. But it wasn't until this month, like until the last few weeks, that the album, like, it felt like it finally got its teeth in me. And it was like it clicked. And I haven't been able to put it down since. This track, Boy in Red, it just felt like such a great just June track for me. Mm. Like it's the super chill vibes that I, you know, you expect from Isaiah. But I love the post him coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Isaiah, like, it just has
not him coming out, him being forced out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, but now that it's, because there was the initial response where it was like, you know, he was forced out, it was fucked up, it, you know, it was violating. And this album feels a little bit more comfortable. Like, he's like on the other side. Like, obviously, he's talking about it on the album on certain tracks. But this one in particular, I was just like, this is just my like bisexual representation anthem. Between this and the Tyler track and the last album, like, I can't remember the name of it. But I just love the, just some like good old bisexual representation is fantastic. But the Boy in Red absolutely was a banger. This is going to be something I've been playing all June, and I'm going to be playing this and the rest of the album, you know, the rest of the year for sure.
Yeah, I've been listening to this since May. It's been in steady rotation. Scared to Look Down. And is it 7 Up Freestyle? No, 719 Freestyle. Incredible. His flows on both are incredible. I do want to respond to, I think
the production's fantastic.
Oh my God. And his brother is on this too. Like, he's bringing in some new ears. Or it feels like we're not necessarily getting, because I don't think any one song feels totally out of the wheelhouse or house style of Isaiah that we've come to know. And I do think, I do want to lend a little credence to your feeling of the album kind of washing over you or like slowly overtaking you, as opposed to having something big and launching and grabbing that you know, feels like here's the single. Why? And we had same shit, but
yeah,
it like here's the major single that's anchoring the project, and here are the major movements that feel like we're riding these highs and lows. It really does kind of feel like a beach, like the surf as it kind of like washes up on the beach and then washes back. Like it really
that
just feels like it wears down on you like that. And even when you open, though, when the project opens, the new Sublime, it almost doesn't feel like the opening of an album. It almost feels like track 4 in an album, if that makes any sense. So I don't know if that's an experience unique to me, but when I first started the project, I had to check the track and I'm like, did I start at the beginning? Because it doesn't have a, we're at the beginning of the album. Here's the sound that's really going to grab you.
Yeah.
It really feels like a very slow movement. I will say, as far as, and this isn't to take away the bisexual representation at all, or your interpretation of that, in Boy in Red, so the lyric that I think you're referring to in there is the, you know, he's speaking to this girl, telling her he'll be his everything. I'll be your boyfriend, your girlfriend, this, this, and that. I'll be whatever you need me to be to make this relationship work, or I value that you so much as a person that I'm willing to be whatever I need to be to make the relationship work. He was asked about this too recently, and I believe it was in the Breakfast Club interview. Him and Charlamagne were going back and forth, and asked specifically about that song and this lyric in regards to the representation. And he said he was coming at it more of, but I guess that is the let me not well, the bisexual experience is, what would you say, is that more of the how awkward?
Well, I want to hear what his thoughts, his coming is
that it's like, I will be whatever I need to be to kind of make it work in this relationship, not necessarily I'm going to be your boyfriend girlfriend, but whatever I need to be is what I need to be to make this relationship work. I'm not sure if that captures the bisexual experience in its entirety, but
it was more just the like, and like, obviously this isn't like exclusive to the bisexual experience, but it was just the like knowing how to be friends with women that's not sexualized is like part of the like, well, like, I don't know, when you are into people regardless of gender presentation, then, you know, it's all that matters is what's beneath or whatever. So like, I find it easier than some of my peers. But I do find it easier than some of my peers to like treat women as people and have like legitimate friendships that don't feel like, I know a lot of women like try to have friendships with men. It's like, at some point he's going to confess his love for me. And I feel like the way that Isaiah describes it in Boy in Red, where it's like, no, like, I love you because of you as a person. So like, if I can be your boyfriend, cool. If not, like, that's cool too. Like, I'm going to be there for you no matter what, because I love you. It does, be it romantic, be it sexual, be it as best buds, like, that's, well, I'll be there. And like, I that's obviously not exclusive to bisexuals as a ability or feeling, but I find it somewhat easier in my experience to have those kind of intimate friendships with women where it doesn't need to be sexual. It's just like kind of based on a level of just trust and familiarity. And so like, that was kind of where I was coming at from it. And it just, the vulnerability, the like emotional connection of it all, just felt like something that it's like, you don't get to see men talk about that shit that much. It was great.
Fantastic track. Fantastic. So, I mean, hip hop is in a place where it is, one, we've gotten some fantastic albums over the course of the last couple of weeks. YG's album has been great. Nick Grant's album has been great. Tierra Whack's album has been incredible. I just heard the Rhapsody single, God Got an Afro. That has been fantastic. There's been a lot. And the subject matter has been so varied. Stuff that you're hearing, you know, Treetop Bloods talk about, that feels like a lot more in-depth, vulnerable, and kind of weighty, touchy subject matter that's like, wow, I wouldn't have expected that to hear on a YG album. And you're getting things like almost mainstream bops from like Nick Grant, Dope Bitch. I want everybody to go check that out. That was incredible too. So it's weird. There's a lot of voices and a lot of I was trying to bounce off your point of discussing even, or having an openly bisexual rapper in 2026 is a far cry from the hip hop I grew up with in the 90s. Like,
not just one dude. We got a bunch of people.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just like, it's hip hop has come so far that I'm loving it. I want to talk about the track that you will be hearing. It's in Vince Staples' Cotton, coming from his 2026 release, Cry Baby. Right off the bat, this is a really propulsive track, really rhythmic thrum behind it that adds sort of what I feel like is that sort of propulsion that really kind of like gets your foot to kind of tap. Why is he laughing behind the scenes on that?
I want to let you finish your point.
I will keep going then.
I know how it's, the more you talk about yours, I'm like, uh-oh, he's not going to like what I have to say.
I'd be curious to, I still feel like this is, in my opinion, the zenith of the album. I feel like we could crescendo to this song with the project. And I picked this in many ways because I feel like even with the music video, this reflects like the dichotomy of the message behind this project. This project is very Black-centric. It's very incendiary. The title of the album, the cover, you know, Cry Baby. There's a spoiled Trump-esque baby that's wrapped in American flag. It looks like me possibly soiling it, wearing it as a diaper. And this oscillates pretty heavily between a Black love community and Black pain as it relates to white supremacy. And I feel like the music video for Cotton sort of the music video itself being projected over like a cotton sheet, a white sheet, it invites you to experience the wide gamut of the Black American experience. And we like pendulum swing from the best and the worst of this. So, you know, we'll have, I don't know, we're at a wedding, and then we're at the Rodney King beating, and we just kind of go back and forth between these two kind of emotions. And while the project in itself, I think they're like brief interludes into Vince's life, much of it is Vince's outward perspective on the ails that like plague our community. And he confronts us with this in the most inflammatory way possible and really assaults the audience with his ideas about this in no small way. Like, he invites you to spell the N-word or sing the N-word as a lullaby at the end of the first track. And I feel like he does this in much more of an artful way than Young Thug tried to recently. He raps poetically about being choke slammed into the ground by a white cop at an early age and like never sharing that experience with his mom. Lyrics that really fucking hit me. Obviously, this is a cinema a podcast, a cinema-inspired podcast, and Vince has a, along with being a rapper, actor, I mean, Criterion Closet, frequent visitor, he's been on the screen, a fantastic actor. He blends these two, cinema, my love for rap, and the song White Flag, with the lyric, why do you treat me like we in a UFO? Cuff me in the backseat so I can't phone home. And the way he like blends those two with that lyric, love this. I feel like there's, I don't know if it's all successful. I think there are some weak points in, like, let's say, like TV Guide is a track in there that I feel like, feels like a little dated in terms of the subject matter. But by and large, I find the album to be very confrontational in a good way. I think a very important piece of work, and Cotton being the crescendo of that for me, a very solid a track to sort of get us to that rise of and I should say I'm getting long into the breakdown without having talked about the actual track Cotton, but when you're feeling down, you know, pick me up like Cotton, pick up this music up like Cotton, again blending this dichotomy of something really fucked up and something really powerful, it was just something really spiritually fulfilling, and these how we blend this or how we bounce between these two emotions throughout this track and throughout this album, I found to be really poetic and interesting. So I'm gonna invite you all to listen to a little bit of Cotton, but let me get your take. You feel a little differently, it feels, in terms of
Well, so it's funny you kept calling it the crescendo, because I was just like, man, the delivery is just so sleepy for how driving the beat is that I wasn't like, it didn't kind of strike me the same way. I do know, like, hearing you talk about it, though, I absolutely think that a large part of my response to it was when I clicked on it, I clicked on the EP or like the single instead of the album, not realizing. So I didn't realize, I wasn't listening to the full album. I was just listening to like the three tracks. So it was
Black Marmalade.
Yeah, it was Black Marmalade, White Flag, and Cotton. And Cotton was the first one of the three. So listening to those in the wrong order, like, I got the kind of opposite. It didn't build up into it. It felt like it was weird. I didn't like the vibe switch between the tracks that I listened to, but I did not listen to them in the right order. I'm going to go back and listen to the album now, cuz I think I hear what you're saying, and like thinking of it like presented in context like that, I think that I wouldn't have the same reaction to it, cuz my experience listening to Cotton like a couple times, cuz I, you know, listened to the first pass and was like, oh yeah, I like digging it, going again, and like, okay, kind of like, I didn't pick up on everything cuz I just don't like have any ear for lyrics like that. But the vibe just felt so weird. But so now that hearing you kind of describe why the vibe felt weird, I want to listen to it in context of like the album kind of building up to that point of catharsis, or maybe not catharsis, but at least the peak.
I always love starting with some white guilt. Let's let's move on with the episode as we get into breaking down the latest in
Yeah, right. How am I going to criticize Cotton? Like, let me give my white opinion on Cotton. No, thank you. These young street punks might knock you off when Jesus died up on that cross.
All right, this is Ian McGee shooting the shit about the ish they're effing with. And on today's episode, we got I Love Boosters, the new film by Boots Riley. We have Curry Parker's Obsession. We're going to talk the latest Steven Spielberg Disclosure Day and end with some Comics Corner. Talk a little Spider Noir and Absolute Flash. So looking forward to all of this. We're going to get started with I Love Boosters from Boots Riley coming up after this.
Get your camera out. Let's go live. You know the egregious theft that's been happening at my stores. The boosters take my clothes because they're low-class urban bitches.
Chrissy Smith knows we exist.
I call it triple F. Fashion, forward, philanthropy. I know how to spell philanthropy. Branding, though.
For that, you're a raw ass, make it happen, hustler.
Give it to me. It's mine anyway.
In fashion, humanity is our canvas. But the Velvet Gang is reducing our margins. I can bob and weave.
Chrissy Smith stole my design.
What?
All right, so that was from the trailer of I Love Boosters. Here's a log line for this film. A group of shoplifters take aim at a cutthroat fashion maven by stealing her clothes and reselling them at a lower price. What they call fashion-forward philanthropy. This is written and directed by Boots Riley. This is photographed by Natasha Breyer, I believe. And this is an interesting film. Yeah, got this in theaters. I know we are big Boots supporters on here.
Hell yeah.
You just put me on to, what was the, I'm a Virgo, the television
I'm
show.
I'm a Virgo was the TV series, yeah.
We are both big fans.
Obviously, we both loved Sorry to Bother You.
Yep. So it was, I think I wanted to see Boost in feature mode, and I was happy to see mm-hmm. him everywhere in terms of selling this film on socials, on different, If I'm big with, he popped up on Culture United, which is, you know, a group of, you know, black YouTube reaction personalities.
Reactionaries.
Yeah, don't make that joke. Never mind. this is Maximus Filmmaking from easily one of the more interesting voices working today. And I think this was Boots at his best and worst. To start, we'll go ahead and start with the good. I think Keke Palmer is fantastic in this. She's proven herself to be, you know, a star-making talent. She can carry a film. Really love seeing her here. She's playing a string of like disheveled, misbegotten, belabored protagonists. You know, it's been like kind of put upon a little bit, and which makes her a bit maybe sharp to her friends or pushing people away. It feels like she kind of plays that a type of protagonist. I think a lot of the cast here is a really fun cast with a lot of chemistry. Demi Moore, who's having a really interesting later stage career turn, gets to ham it up even a little bit more here, where she's playing like a Anna Wintour kind of fashionista, but even more unabashed, kind of just like really just. Like she calls them ghetto urban bitches at one point in the film. So really, like there's really interesting, fun business.
I mean, that's not worse. The worst thing we've heard out of fucking those people, the people that
the people that she's representing in the film. No shots at Demi. Lakeith Stanfield's a lot of fun in this one too, and he's a frequent collaborator with Boots. Mm. And in this one, he's not the protagonist. He's much more of the side character, but his side character, the profile or the story of his side character is so goddamn unforgettable and hilarious. I really liked it a lot. And spot him if you see him. Don Cheadle's in this one in a role where he's there, but you got to kind of know he's there for it to,
Interesting.
But it's really, really funny. The bad though, I feel like the script, is something of a little bit of a mess. It's kind of convoluted at points. I feel like there is the community forward communist art, you know, messaging to the film but then it kind of spirals into a lot of ideas that I'm not really sure coalesce or really kind of congeal there at the end. And I feel like the wacky zaniness that we're used to in Boots, just as a creator, a personality, I feel like that is most indulgent here. It doesn't all kind of, because there are points in where I'm just like, it feels a bit soapboxy, but there's not enough justification for it to be there other than wanting to communicate. Like, it doesn't feel like it has much to do with the story or character, and much more to do with I want to get this message across, which is fine, I feel like, but too many of those tangents, then I start to, you know, I'm starting to like look at my watch a bit and start to turn it out of like, wow, we were really on this tangent for really, you know, a really long time.
Boots film though. Like, you're like, you kind of get what you signed up for. Like, I think that the target audience for, and like, I don't think, not to say that that's not a valid criticism, because especially, you know, obviously want to go outside of just like who your usual, like the people you already have guaranteed to support. But also, like, if you go see a Boots Riley film, you're going to get some, you know, commentary on the state of society. Like, you're going to get some capitalist, you know, soapbox speeches. Like, I think that that's part of what I'm buying when I'm buying a ticket to a Boots Riley.
I think where the blend of story and messaging, say, and Sorry to Bother You, and the spoiler alert for that film with the equestrian, like the use of workhorse, capitalist principles or philosophy that keep a workforce down and to appear like fucking cattle or like equestrians, like, yeah, the blend of that is beautiful and poetic, and I think there you found the synthesis of like trying to get the message across and then making it wacky and zany and having a point to be there. Here I'm finding it to be a lot less successful, where the blend of the story and what you're trying to say, like, I don't think that those, I'll allow you, maybe when you see the film, maybe we'll have a sharper idea of what I'm talking about there, but it just doesn't feel like it didn't congeal in the way that I feel like I've seen him do in the past, or Virgo. We've seen him do in the past. So,
I mean, I'm a Virgo does have a lot of episodes where people will like turn to camera and give a monologue, but like a, let's do a quick aside to, you know, educate you on some stuff. Like,
yeah,
there's at least like two or three of those moments in the series too, but also you have a lot more time to do that over the course of 9 episodes or whatever, where you can get away with that. I don't think you're wrong at all, but it's like that DNA has been there, but maybe in the feature film format, it's a little more glaring, a little less successful.
Yeah.
But
this is a genuine spectacle. It was never boring. I feel like it's incredibly crafted. And if you want to know more or see more about the craft, I know that Boots did a somewhat making of, almost like a pre behind the scenes, where he's talking with his key collaborators and they're going through almost like what Ryan Coogler did with the aspect ratio and explaining what you would be getting in different formats going to see the film. He did something similar to that, but even more, you know, we're talking about Boots, so more of just like, here's all the production elements that we did and this is how we kept all this. So it's a really fun, like, I want to say it's maybe like a 10-15 minute video that we'll attach to the show notes on this one. So go ahead and watch that, and I'm gonna toss it to you, McGee. Let's get obsessed. I'm obsessed about
talk a little obsession.
Coming up after this.
Have you ever actually like flirted with Nikki?
I'm gonna go get some shots.
I'll come with you if she means this much to you. And I know she does. Say, Nikki, I think we should grab a drink sometime.
Nikki, wait. I was gonna ask you,
what?
I lost my train of thought.
Hi.
Good night. What else?
Why?
One wish, Willow. You only get one wish. I wish Nikki Freeman loved me more than anyone in the entire world.
I love you so, 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 so much.
only the branch of a willow tree could conjure.
It's weird how you two are dating all of a sudden. Like, super dating.
I think Nikki is going through something.
Like what? Is she okay?
No.
Jeez. What kind of spells you put on her?
All right, that was from the trailer of Obsession. This is written and directed by Curry Barker. Logline: after breaking the mysterious one-wish willow to win his crush's heart, a hopeless romantic finds himself getting exactly what he asked for, but soon discovers that some desires come at a dark, sinister price. Classic Monkey's Paw setup. This is, like I said, written and directed by Curry Barker. This was... I guess we're not doing the full. I don't have to do the full. So Barker was a YouTuber. He did like sketch comedy on YouTube. Mm. I hadn't honestly seen any of his stuff. I'm too old for him, apparently. But you know, from what I've seen, it's great. The wider kind of talk about Obsession in at least film circles lately, I don't know how much of it has made its way into your feed, but it is, you know, made an obscene amount of money, right? Like right now, yeah. What, over 300 million, it looks like 334 million on a $750,000 budget.
$750,000
budget. Jeez. So this was a micro budget for yeah. sure. So this is part of the, kind of, I don't want to say controversy, but the discussion around it. Hold on.
Is it a Blumhouse film?
It's not. It was Focus Features. Oh, it is Blumhouse. Blumhouse is on board. Interesting. Oh yeah, they came on and when it went to TIFF. Okay. So they Focus Features got distribution rights after its premiere at Toronto Film Festival. And then Jason Blum and Blumhouse comes on board as executive producer. So there's been a discussion because of Sally Choi, who is the art director on the film, made a post talking about how she was making $300 a day on the movie, and now you know this movie that she was, you know, wearing so many hats for is now making upwards of $250 million. And just about kind of feeling conflicted about, you know, proud of her work, proud that it's reaching that success, but seeing, you know, still when you're, you know, having to make rent and watching the thing that you made be raking in money. I get where she comes from. So there's a lot of debate about, you know, I mean, I saw a lot in like filmmaking discussions, like up, like with people in the industry, of like people pissed, like she should have kept her mouth shut. This is just the way the industry works. Like you get paid, you know, you now you can charge more money because of the success that you have this under your belt, which is a valid point. It's an argument. There's also the argument to be made of like something is systemically wrong that. Not that you don't just get a piece of the pie, because it's not just about the money, but it is about like the representation for the work that you've done and the respecting your crew, valuing your crew, and not like in film so as in the rest of the world, where the gap in power and money between the people at the top and the people at the bottom is ever widening. And so the more that, you know, you're just replaceable, you're another low-wage employee, that if you don't do what they say, they just replace you with another low-wage employee, is a lot of non-union work. Not just in film industry, just in non-union work in general. There's arguments to be had about, you know, if this show flips, it obviously goes for a lot more money, it becomes a whole totally different show. There's, you know... Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm in the habit of calling everything a show, but yeah, it's not it's funny because it's from the industry perspective, not from like the old man perspective, but it comes out the same way.
It all washes out the same in the end.
Yeah, right. You get to a point, you can't, the lines blur, you don't really know what you, where you're coming from anymore. So I think that there's an interesting conversation we had. Like, personally, I do think, like, obviously you signed up for it. Obviously, you're going to make more money off of it. But there is, like, I was in a position where I had enough hours to flip union at one point. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know union guys to get you union work,
what's the point
of you flip and then you're just left on an island. Like, there is, it's not as easy as people make it seem. Mm-hmm. Of like, you worked on one thing that got big and now you're big. Mm-hmm. It's like, it doesn't really work like that. You have to have people that are going to call you for things. And like, sure, you might take better calls, but like, there is still going to be, like, largely your day rate's going to go up a bit, but it's not going to help you get healthcare. It's not going to help you pay rent now. And I think that that's something that, like, the whole above the line, below the line nonsense, like, for people that are not in the industry, there's like above the line positions have always been lead actors, producers, director, screenwriter, mm-hmm. and casting director.
People carrying their weight on set, you know.
Yeah, it's like, so literally department heads, you know, your art director, your production designer, your cinematographer, like, literally every department head, I don't understand how they're not above the line. Like, how do they, by default,
that's always been,
you make
weird.
Your day rate and you go home, and it's the people who shape the world of the movie, the people who shape the day in, day out production, you make your day rate and you go home. And if the movie makes $1 billion, well, here's a fucking ribbon.
Because this industry was started by carnival barkers and gangsters. You know what I mean? This is the entertainment. Welcome to Hollywood.
It's like, yeah, so of course, but it's been 100 years. Yeah. It doesn't have to still be run like we're taking advantage of carnies. Like,
but I'm also not. The surprise is what I find surprising, or not the. I shouldn't say the surprise. I guess the reaction. I've always felt similar. It just doesn't make the delineation is. I mean, it just doesn't make sense at all. It feels like mm-hmm. everyone should receive some type of residual from the work that they've done.
Yeah, which is artist equity, which is what I want to talk about too.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I should let you get to your major point, because that was.
But no, I want to hear your point first, because then I'll bring up the.
I think it's just
artist,
I think,
equity.
The reaction. I didn't see much of the reaction to what did you say her name was?
Sally Choi.
Sally Choi.
Yeah, Sally Choi.
But this conversation about residuals kind of, you know, left its way back in the conversation, and I think maybe it's a whole new generation of film school students learning this for the first time, and we've just been around the block a little bit. We're just like, it feels like it sucks. I know there have been efforts to address that to an extent. What was the company that Matt and Ben had started at one point?
Obviously, so that's artist equity. That's what I was going to bring up. Was the So yeah, it's on the Matt Damon and Ben Affleck's production company that they started when they did the Michael Jordan movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think
the Night one.
I think that was their first movie. Was Air?
I thought it was the Night with the Ridley one, but maybe. Oh, they were able to do it through their own production house, like Ben.
Yeah, for their production company started, where they're giving points. I know at least that on Air that everybody got points, like the 1500 person crew or whatever. Mm-hmm. Everybody's getting a percentage of the back end, mm-hmm. As if everybody's above the line, mm-hmm. and it's all negotiated and included in their rates, which is like, especially if you're doing a lower budget. Conversely, it feels like that should be the norm for low budget stuff, because you're asking so much of people to. Like $250, $300 a day for a 12-hour day, that's 14 billing hours. Like, you're not making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You're making, you know, a good fast food job. Like, you're a manager at a local fast food chain rate. Like, we're not talking like Hollywood rates here. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think that it would be perfectly reasonable to buy, like, have it be the standard. If we had film unions worth a damn that, like, fought for our people and didn't give us shit fucking contracts, and, you know, then maybe, like, you know, non-union would have at least some like, where to start other than the absolute bottom of the barrel. But so much of it does just feel like a meat grinder where you're infinitely replaceable. So small concessions, like just giving points. On large, weirdly, I feel like if you're on a Marvel movie, you're fucking obviously, like, it doesn't matter if you're a camera operator. Like, you're doing what the machine tells you to do.
Oh, you feel that, like, you have, like, more value on a smaller set? Like, you...
Yeah, I feel like each crew member feels like they're contributing more to what the final product is on a small set versus if I'm cam-opping on Captain America 7, I don't think that I have any meaningful impact on what this movie looks like.
No, that makes
less sense to me to get points.
But I do think you're closer
than on something smaller.
I think you're closer towards that bit you were speaking about earlier, in terms of, like, if you turn union, if you flip union, you're on a Marvel set, I think you're more likely to get that kind of work, or you've made those connections to get that. Because I don't think those type of gigs come by, like, those are, like, really got to know people to kind of get in there. And then if you're on that type of set, then I think you're able to kind of snowball that shit into more of those type of gigs, or more of those union type of gigs. But I guess I'm saying that in response to, you're a bigger fish in a smaller pond on an independent set, but in while you may not have the same kind of creative impact or control on a larger or triple A production, you may have those connections to keep you on that type of work to kind of keep the ball rolling.
It's anything to give people more ownership and more, like, because, like, there's so much, like, people want to do the fucking work. Like, people want to make shit. And it's tough because it's also, like, I know it's a tough investment. Like, if you want to make money, you're not investing in film. Like, there's more reliable gambles to take on an investment. Like, it's a pretty risky move. I totally get, like, not wanting to discourage anyone from investing in film. But, like, you brought up Blumhouse earlier. Like, that's Jason Blum's whole thing of, like, you know, you finance 10, however you say it. You finance 10 movies, and, like, three of them make their money back, and one of them pays for the rest.
That's about my next point.
I get that that's movie math, too. So I think there's a middle ground. I don't think that it's, like, pure... every single person should have, like the points should be equally distributed between every crew member. Like, as much of a commie as I am, I get why that's not the case, because that's not the setup for financing a movie. Like, that's just not functional unless a lot of things structurally change way outside of the film industry. Like, there's a lot of things got to go right before we're ever to that point. It would be sweet, but that's not, like, the world. But I think there's a happy middle ground between that and here's your day rate, now fuck off.
I'm wondering what the points look like even in the system that, you know, Matt and Ben are trying to orchestrate, and what maybe looks like a middle ground for you between what's possible and what's practical for what we have going on now in our current system. What are the points? Like, what do you think that amounts to on a residual basis for, let's say, RPA number whatever? Like, what do you think that actually, like, looks like? And B, like, what would you, if we were to imagine a world in which this system kind of worked, what is the middle ground in our fantasy production house here? Like,
not to suck off Ben and Matt too much,
particularly not Ben with this AI shit too. That's a little disappointing.
Yeah, that shit pisses me off. They, you know, nobody's fucking perfect. Like, these guys suck too. But just as an example in this particular conversation, on their whatever, like, garbage Netflix movie they made, I love that I'm trying to compliment them and we can't resist. This is why we're never going to. This is a quick Patreon plug. Listen to us talk and realize that we're never going to get any major support. No one's going to run commercials on this shit when I'm trying to say nice things.
I think we speak words. Words have power. I think we will find somebody that would be willing to back us a little
bit. Oh, yeah. I'm just saying, I'm much more willing and able to find individual people that are going to throw us a few bucks rather than our corporate overlord.
Dollar Shave Club would find value here. Why wouldn't I think we're just putting that in the air.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to it if somebody wants to give us money. But in this one, so the Netflix movie that they made recently, it was The Rip, which looked like straight trash, but they did it was like a one-time performance bonus. So since it's streaming, they don't have a piece of the box office that they're distributing out as points. It was basically they negotiated a performance metric with Netflix of like what the expectation was for eyeballs. And then if they hit that hit number, then everybody would get a bonus at that point in post-production. So it's not so much of a like ongoing residuals as it is a like one-time bonus if it performs well.
Just the people in post-production or?
No. I'm like everybody that got everybody on the crew got a piece.
Okay.
But so everybody gets the bonus like once it gets released. Like, you know, you make your money on the day and then you get a bonus later.
Yeah. You said production, post-production or something. So I
I don't know why I said post-production.
I got you. Yeah.
I meant like post-release and I said post-production because my brain was in department mode.
Let's maybe spend 60 seconds on this and we'll move on, guys, to a disclosure day. But what is a perfect world, not a perfect world, I'm sorry, what does a world look like, a practical system of this magnitude, when you have hundreds of people on set, you want to give them a living wage, you want to give them residuals that kind of value their work in perpetuity? What does it look like? I guess that would be part of that. I guess that would be a sort of a universal healthcare system that takes a lot of the weight off.
That's exactly what I was meant earlier, where I was like, for this to work, a lot of things got to change that don't have anything to do with film.
Right.
It's just rent needs to be cheaper and healthcare needs to be more accessible. And then we could get a lot more art out of our artists.
Yeah.
That would just be, you know, it's almost like these things are good for everybody in society as a whole benefits. Because everybody consumes art, baby, and you feel better when you are feeling good and healthcare. Fuck.
Well, we almost got it there. We'll blame it on the healthcare or lack thereof. And move on to Spielberg's Disclosure Day. I'm excited to talk to you about late-stage Spielberg coming up after this.
What did you steal?
Secrets. The data they paid me to protect.
Are they people?
No.
Good morning, Kansas City. Let's take a look at today. Today is today's.
Do you understand what she's saying?
I hear her. It's gibberish. I can't understand it.
And I can.
What's happening to me?
People are starved for the truth. I'm a part of it now. I'm just sorry they made you a part of it too.
Hello, Jane. Please. Have a seat.
All right, so that was from Trailer Disclosure Day. Here's the log line. A meteorologist and a cybersecurity expert find themselves at the center of a movement to expose the government's cover-up of an extraterrestrial secret. This is directed by Steven Spielberg. This is photographed by, I think it's Janusz. I always forget it. How do you pronounce his name? Janusz Kaminski. All right, and this is starring Emily Blunt, Josh O'Connor, Colin Firth, and Coleman Domingo. This is the latest Spielberg film. Later stage Spielberg. Where are we at, McGee? We much into later stage Spielberg work? Do you think he peaked in the 90s, early 2000s? How interested are you in Spielberg's later stage career?
I mean, I'm ready to... that was the thing. I felt like he was doing a like almost like Scorsese-esque thing where it was like everybody, especially with West Side Story and Fablemans, everybody was like vibrating because it was like, oh shit, like Spielberg's on his shit.
Yeah.
Like he has hit it. And I mean, you mentioned Janusz Kaminski up top. I kind of felt the same way with him. It was like his 2000s era stuff, your War Horse and Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln looked fine.
About War Horse.
Yeah, right. Fucking War Horse. Lincoln looked fine. It was didn't blow me away. It looked pretty fine.
I thought it looked fantastic.
It looked good.
Yeah,
it looked fantastic, but it was safe.
Okay.
It was very, very good, but it was very, very safe. Okay. It looked exactly like I expected it to look. And Ready Player One was kind of the same thing, where it was like, yeah, that's what I thought that would be.
But I thought there were a lot of inventive sequences and action, like blending that kind of chaos together. I thought he did, you know.
Yeah, Spielberg's still a master at camera movement, and that's what I was expecting out of what we're talking about now. Disclosure Day? God.
That I was really excited. I was really taken by his version of West Side Story in terms of camera movement, production design, costume. Seeing Spielberg handle a musical, I think it was great. I really had a lot of fun with that. And like you mentioned, this Fablemans had I'm not going to say it was my favorite Spielberg movie ever, but I thought it was a really entertaining film, really sweet. And to learn,
it was really interesting to see, like, oh, this is what our elder statesman is doing with his, like, you know, 50 years of being at the top.
Right.
Like, you know, where do you go from there? And to like West Side Story and Fablemans was so interesting because it was felt so like self-reflective, obviously.
Can I say something about that? I feel like he's gotten, what are I write here? He's like latter-day Spielberg has sort of morphed into something maybe a little less commercially impactful and more personally insightful. And it feels like he's drawing that lens inward, and we're seeing a lot of those themes that he would explore, like, let's say, family and loss and E.T. And dealing with, like, divorce and
fucking Close Encounters.
And Close Encounters, you know what I mean?
So that's, the link here between Fablemans and Disclosure Day, I felt like, was so clearly Close Encounters of, like, okay, so you made a sci-fi movie about a dad just picking up and leaving his family when you were dealing with some shit then, and now we've gone full circle and like gotten to the root of that nerve, and then now we're doing Disclosure Day, which kind of felt like a riff off of Close Encounters thematically as well. So it was like, okay, like,
yeah,
are we getting into this? Like, what is, I don't quite see what the angle is, but like what's gonna happen with it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you so and I feel like that question, I went into this film ready to answer, and this film presents a lot of these questions. Like, the story itself is shrouded in mystery. There's a very private and highly classified military event that happens and is made public, and all these parties are sort of scrambling to either cover up or disclose the entirety of what, you know, we know, or what the government knows. And I think we as an audience are in for a very long and dull ride, if I'm being honest. It wasn't a film that I really found satisfying in the conclusion of those I found a satisfying answer in its conclusion. To make a long story short, I feel like the existence of aliens or being presented with that information in 2026 would in my opinion have less world stopping consequences and effects as presented in the film than they would in reality. I think in the way that the events are played out in Steven's head is hearkening back to a world, an older world. And by and large, I was kind of feeling a little like seeing Spielberg get a little old if I'm being
honest. Oh, no.
Like, where it's like the things that would capture or frighten or inspire awe in him, I think the world is kind of and not by any. I think he's in a world that is a lot more ready to trust their media and a lot more able to work with one another to solve issues, large global issues. It feels like some of the stuff, some of the revelations that are made in the film in terms of, hey, I don't want to get into huge spoilers, but hey, there's this, it's out there here, see it. And everyone stops and everyone everyone's convinced and everyone believes right away. And no one's just like, no AI talk or this and that, or no, not like it's just, nothing's being undercut. It doesn't. And that's probably a very basic or a very limited exploration of that theme that he's getting across. I may need another viewing or two to really cement what I'm seeing here. But the feeling of it was, I'm not sure we're in that world anymore. And I feel like that's kind of passed us by. I do think there are a number of interesting collaborators that in some way make it worth watching. Like, I think Colman Domingo is having an amazing couple years here, and he's playing sort of the arbitrator, the orchestrator, the conductor of the resistance in a really interesting way. I'm forgetting how you piece together the question in the beginning, but this feels like a film full of ideas that are a little dated, and the actual scripted adventure and answering those questions aren't as enticing and interesting to stick around with for 2 hours. And there are long stretches of the film, albeit with some very obvious action bits to it that I feel like we've seen before. There's not a whole lot to grab onto, and there's not a whole lot of new like when you're bringing up their when we're bringing up things like Close Encounters in comparison to Disclosure Day, and I'm not seeing a whole lot of I'm not seeing the idea pushed that much further. I'm not seeing the questions get much more sophisticated. I'm not seeing a world which reflects a world that I feel like we're in 2026.
It's spread out. It's too spread out. Like, there's I think the Close Encounters being so intimately about like one man kind of losing his mind that you get to explore more because you can go deeper. Like, it's just in a feature length, you don't really. I don't know if you can get that kind of depth from an ensemble cast in the same way, where you're giving everybody time to shine and also getting enough time to really dig into some weird shit. Like, you can, obviously, but there's just like something needs to be sacrificed at the altar there. And I didn't get the vibe from this movie that was the case. I want to make a comparison to you and see if I'm on the money. I think the way that you're saying you reacted to, like, oh no, is Spielberg getting old, was kind of my feeling with Irishman. Where I've come around to the movie now, I think, especially post Killers of the Flower Moon, where I'm like, okay, I feel like I'm seeing the way that this got refined and that the technique is still there, and that, like, doing a movie this long, you know, in the time when The Irishman first got released, I was down with it, but it was also one of those where I'm like, I don't blame anyone else for absolutely hating this. Like, I can see what you see. I'm just fine with indulging in it because it's like candy to me. But like, it felt a little bit like, uh-oh, did he get a little too old and he's just going to do whatever he wants now?
I feel like I've always read Irishman as being a much more self-aware capstone to Scorsese's career, or a point in his career, than this film ever feels like it's you know, where we're placing it in Steven's career, or at least an overture and overview about what he's been through. Like, Irishman lends itself to like looking back on, you know, how he's handled the gangster picture throughout his career, how he's handled, you know, De Niro and Pesci's frequent collaborators, and kind of placing him in his worlds. I've never understood the harsh criticisms of Irishman in relation to it being lesser Scorsese. That's just not a take that I
I would never call it a lesser.
I find it. I find there are elements that he won't let go of in that film that doesn't help it for sure. Like De Niro beating up the dude in the grocery.
Everybody hates that scene. Yeah,
just need, that was awful from top to bottom. But I think he was not as sharp as ever. Isn't it's the reflection looking back, the reflection on death, blah blah blah, blah where he's gotten to that I appreciate in that film, and I think he's self aware enough to comment on acutely while still kind of having the same Scorsese prowess. Here, I'm almost feeling like it's not, again, and you made your take on it very clear that how you're feeling. He still has all the tools there to get it done, but maybe he's getting a little old, if I'm reading your take on, or some of the take on Irish, correctly. Almost, I do feel like that about Disclosure Day, but it's like the conversation's a little stale too. Like the tools are there, but the conversation's a little stale. Where I'm just like, I don't know if these ideas are really all that. Like this would have been hot, and if this was 87, this would have been hot. Like this would have been fire in 87, but now in 2026, I'm like,
Interesting. I still want to see it. I'm still probably going to see it just to see it.
Yeah, but I would want you, and I would want another viewing. I don't even know if I would. I would want you to see it and see if I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, then I would want another viewing.
I'll report back, and I'll see if you need to take another dip in.
But so that was Scorsese's Disclosure Day, currently in theaters. Again, not a film I responded strongly to, but not a film I would ever tell anybody to not see in theaters. I think any of our Harrell.
He's not.
Masters.
I like that we're talking about him like he's a billion years old. Like, yeah,
he's not that old at all. But any of our the Grandmasters, they decided to take a swing. We should always be there to support. And so I would say go catch in theaters. Maybe your opinion mileage will vary on extraterrestrial revelations, but this one didn't particularly work for me. But
Spielberg's only 79.
Yeah,
I mean, that's old. 80.
Yes. I don't know why I went 77 in my head. I was like, yeah, okay. Still spry as ever. Still spry as ever. Still has it in the interviews. He's still Steven.
I guess, George Miller's 81. He's only 2 years older. It's funny because I think of George Miller as a lot older than Spielberg.
Do you? I think George Miller young. Maybe because I didn't.
I mean, he's crazy. He doesn't come across like an old man. He comes across like a fucking crackhead, but.
But maybe because his, like, I didn't really lock into him until Babe, maybe. I don't even know if I was aware that was a George Miller film.
Yeah.
I guess so. That doesn't count. When did you see Road Warrior? What would you say you've seen Road Warrior? Did you grow up with Road Warrior?
Oh, like as a kid on TV, but like not
knowing it was him?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like, I don't know, I wasn't as aware of directors at that point. Like you just seen how new Mad Max ruled. I think it was at some point, probably it was Happy Feet. When Happy Feet blew up.
Yeah, because Happy Feet was huge. And he probably did a lot of
it. Crazy successful. Yeah. Other than people would be like, that's from the guy who did fucking Mad Max. And then you're like, what the? And then that's probably being aware of.
I definitely know
it's like, oh shit, he did Babe too?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Because in college, I had a professor. I can't remember what the class was or what we were studying, but he was a huge fucking fan of Babe too. Pig in the City. I fucking hated that one. That was like, I love Babe 1. Cannot stand Babe 2. Was never a fan of it. And that ended up being George's one where I was just like, yeah, not a fan.
Which, have you seen Witches of Eastwick? Can we talk Witches of Eastwick?
I think that you were going to put that on the, we didn't.
That's on the list.
Yeah. Because it reminded me of, what was it, Hocus Pocus, where there were three witches? Is that also three witch story? And I remember when we were talking about you putting it on, I think I was confusing the two. I was thinking it was Hocus Pocus, and you were talking about it being Witches of Eastwick or something shit.
Okay. I'll put that. I'll keep that in the back of my head for a pick, maybe possible pick.
Yeah, and let's talk about Let's get into some Comics Corner, McGee. Wrap this episode up. And wrap some of these people up in some way.
We could just cut Comics Corner and leave it here.
What are we, where are we at, an hour?
We're at like an hour, but I mean.
Yeah. All right, so that was Ian McGee shooting the shit about the ish they're effing with. Let's talk about this raffle we got, McGee. This ongoing raffle. This
yes,
Nick Cage raffle. We talked a little Spider Noir. Let's talk a little Nick Cage.
Yeah, track. speaking of the Spider Devil himself, Mr. Mandy. We've been doing a raffle on socials over the summer months here. So, you know, give us a review on your podcast app of choice. You know, give us a follow on one of the socials. Comment, basically anything counts as an entry. Shoot us a message with your address so we can get you on the mailing list. And we'll put you in the raffle here. We got some like kind of random shit we'll be doing probably at the end of the week here, maybe one in July or so. And then at the end of the summer, there's a fucking just incredible, ridiculous jacket customized by Uncle Ant with a fully sequenced Nick Cage face.
Really, really cool.
It's so like fucking good.
And swipe your
it
hand
looks so
and
good.
It looks like it did.
Yeah, it's like red if it's all facing down, and you swipe your hand up and you get the big reveal.
Yeah.
Great piece.
Catch on our
incredible
is it on our socials?
Opportunity.
It's on our socials, right? The jacket?
I've been meaning to post it. I don't think I posted it yet. Okay. I'll post it with the episode.
We'll be posting that soon. And we got a new theme coming up here. So we've been, obviously things have been a little dicey in terms of episodes and
consistency
in the last
baby.
Couple weeks. I've been busy in a way. We're back now on a little bit more consistent basis, so we're starting a new theme here in
so
July.
Mysterious.
Oh, yeah, yeah. International Men of Mystery. so we're covering, so we missed Pride Month. We want to circle back and circle the block and celebrate our LGBTQ. I've already fucked it up. I literally didn't even get the fucking. We want to celebrate.
I'll take it. You can toss it.
There you go. Oh, well, we want to celebrate Pride Month. We want to celebrate these films. I'm gonna toss it to McGee for our new theme for July.
Yeah, we're doing Pride in what was it? Oh, America the Fabulous, Pride in July. You know, for many reasons, there's a lot of films that we could go over to talk about the state of America, but in lieu of lecturing each other about the woes of living in the declining empire that we live in, let's just run it back and go with some of our favorite Pride month movies in July, since we, you know, took our sweet time. We were too, well, you know, we're too much of allies to make you have to listen to anything in Pride Month. So we put it off until.
Sure.
That was the reasoning.
What do we kick it off with? What's the.
Kicking off with The Birdcage. I didn't pull up the long one. I mean, should I send you? Do we do a classic send you the poster and you guess the log line or guess the plot?
We can.
Put on some hold music. All right. So I just texted you the poster for 1996's The Birdcage.
Gene Hackman. Oh, I do know this. Okay, this is the Robin Williams one. All right.
Yep, Robin Williams, Nathan Lane, Gene Hackman. Yeah, directed by Mike Nichols. You
really?
Know this movie.
Mike Nichols?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little Lane May early in the podcast run. Nichols and Elaine May, long
Mikey
time.
And Nikki, yeah,
yeah, long time collaborators. All right, so we finally got a Mike Nichols film in here, The Birdcage. This has Robin Williams, Gene Hackman, Nathan Lane, and Diane West, all kind of standing in front of what looks like to be a theater. Come As You Are is the tagline. I'm assuming this has to do because Gene Hackman and Diane are kind of dressed conservatively. I guess Nathan would be too, but I guess I'm bringing in what I know about Nathan into the maybe that's not fair.
Hey, you made me snort a little bit, but use it.
Okay, all right. So I'm assuming that Nathan and Robin are coming into the this conservative establishment. Let's say that this is a failing theater. Maybe they're an off-Broadway, some kind of lounge that's failing. They're looking to kind of stir up interest in the public, like putting on some shows. They hire Nathan and Robin, and they sort of bite off a little bit more than they can chew in terms of the flamboyantness that they're going to put into these shows, because there's, you know, a conservative audience. They're not necessarily want a little bit more of that flair. They didn't expect some of the flair to kind of come with Nathan and Robin. And somehow or another, they learn the power of love and entertainment is universal, no matter who it comes from. And those are that's how we resolve the issues of the film. How close did I get?
I mean, in a way, you're right. Okay. In a world.
Okay.
Except for, you know, some pretty essential elements, but I'll go ahead and read you the log line here. So, a gay cabaret owner and his drag queen companion agree to put up a false straight front so that their son can introduce them to his fiance's right-wing conservative parents.
Yeah.
So, different inciting incident motivation.
So it's
motivation,
Robin
but
and Nathan bringing in Gene and Diane to the club?
Obviously you'll see, but yeah. Robin Williams and Nathan Lane's characters, their son is getting married.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, her parents want to meet his parents. And so they're like, oh, well, we have to not be ourselves. We have to, like, be presentable for this setup. And it's a lot of that. But this is one of those movies that is absolutely, like, it's gorgeous. It's hilarious. It's broadly appealing, but also is telling such a specifically, like, giving voice to a story that is very impactful and, like, was a real story to, you know, countless number of households, but was just something that maybe I think was a lot of people's maybe first experience with hearing this story told. So I think it's going to be a really fun movie to watch. I'm really excited to get your takes on it. I think obviously you've seen some of the players involved just from looking at the poster, and I have a feeling you already know what your response is going to be. I think that we're going to have a good time next week for sure.
Hell yeah. So that was 1996's Birdcage, available on Tubi, Pluto for free, Roku. Looks like you have a lot of free options.
Love those free ones.
Yep, yeah. And or Amazon Prime. For some of the more mainstream viewers. But yeah, looking forward to that. It's going to be a really fun film to break down for our American Fabulous Pride in July. Want to give our shout outs to our brothers and sisters in the LGBTQ.
God damn it.
I thought I had it at the end there.
You got to keep all those in.
All right, brother, next week.
Next week.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplaybox, theme song by Soulspy. Coming soon, folks.